Good morning, everybody. Could I ask you to please take your seats? And please fill in into the front. Thank you all for coming. I'm Ernie Bauer. I'm the chair for Southeast Asian Studies here at CSIS. We got a particularly interesting morning, and very grateful to our friend Dr. Hugh White, who's visiting from Australia and the Australian National University. Dr. White, and I'd also like to welcome my colleague Chris Johnson, who's the Freeman Chair in China Studies here at CSIS. Dr. White has agreed to talk a little bit about some of the themes that he's been developing in his new book. He's been in Washington for about a week. Had a chance to chat with him beforehand a little bit. As you know, he's been an advisor to Australian prime ministers, defense ministers. He's been a leader in developing the think tank business in Australia. He has been a journalist, a leader in the intel community there. His perspectives are fascinating. What he's done in many ways is draw out a discussion about questions that are hard to ask and hard to answer, about the equilibrium, if you will, if there is one that's possible between the United States and China in Asia. And so we'll be fascinated to hear his remarks. Chris Johnson, as you know, is the chair of our China program here. His background is in the intelligence community in the United States. Chris is going to respond to Dr. White's comments, and I get to sort of referee the whole thing, which is going to be a lot of fun. But you have an assignment here in the audience, which is I really want you guys to listen in and participate. I want you to actively participate in the dialogue after Dr. White and Chris have the remarks. So, Hugh, welcome to Washington. The floor is yours, and thank you again for coming to CSIS.
Well, thank you, and it's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks to CSIS and Elke and so on for putting this together, and it's great to be sharing the platform with Chris. And I'd also particularly like to thank Martha from the ANU office here, who has made my visit work. I gather there's some negotiating to be done up on the hill over the next couple of weeks about the budget. Get Martha, she'll get it sorted out for you. I want to start by talking about where Australia is at the moment. Australia has an extraordinarily significant, long-standing, deep and valued relationship with the United States. And we have an extraordinarily significant, more recent, deepening relationship with China. And one way of framing the choice Australia faces today is to say we're going to have to make a choice between those two relationships. Are we going to stick with the United States or are we going to go with China? I very deeply believe that's the wrong way to conceive Australia's situation. But I do think there is a risk that we will be faced with that choice in future if the United States-China relationship goes badly. The more intense the rivalry between the US and China, the starker the choices Australia faces, the closer we come to the point where we can't develop in each of those relationships what we want. And there's no good future for Australia in which we can't continue to have very much the kind of relationship we've had with the United States for many decades now, and in which we can't continue to develop the kind of relationship with China that we've been developing in recent decades. So the big question for Australia is, how does this relationship look today? How does the US-China relationship look? And the optimistic view, and the view I would say, if I can be disobliging to my own government for a minute, in our government, is that it's actually fine. The trajectory of the US-China relationship is entirely positive. There are a few little niggles, but don't worry, that'll all be sorted out. I don't think that's true. I think the trajectory of the United States-China relationship at the moment is quite dangerous. And that's not just because of what you might broadly call a sort of Mearsheimerian sense of historical determinism that rising powers always end up bad relations with established powers. It's actually observing what's been happening in the relationship over the last few years in particular. And a focus, I think, increasing focus on both sides on the other as a strategic rival. And I take that very seriously, because it seems to me the sources of that rivalry go very deep. And the starting point is that China is, I think, now actively contesting a very stable order in Asia, which we've enjoyed for the 40 years since Nixon went to China in 1972. It's not that it wants to change the territorial order. I don't think it's got serious territorial ambitions. It's not actually that it wants to change the way the order works, as a lot of people have observed. The order works pretty well for China. It just wants to change who's in charge of the order. It likes the bus. Doesn't even mind the journey. Just wants a different driver. And it does boil down to a sense of status. And if anyone thinks that status doesn't matter to countries, they've forgotten how much like people countries are and how significant this can be, and not just to China, it's significant to all of us. I think removing the sense of subordination to America that China accepted in 1972, I think is a very high priority for China indeed. It's less conservative than people hope, because although it's benefited from the status quo, it doesn't believe that element of the status quo, the fact that America's in charge of it, is essential to its own interests. It needs a stable and orderly Asia, but it doesn't believe that US primacy is the only way to achieve that. It can imagine other ways to achieve that. Chinese primacy, for example, looks like a pretty good option to them. And I don't think we should be surprised by this ambition. I'm not saying we should like it. I'd like nothing better than China to decide it was going to accept US primacy as a foundation for the Asian order indefinitely into the future. But we shouldn't be surprised that they don't. In effect, we should be. What would require explanation was if they didn't do what seems, in a sense, natural to countries to do. So the second part of the equation is, where do we see US-China relationships going? Is how does America respond to this Chinese challenge? And I think it's clear, because I believe that the fact of China's challenge is already an established fact. It's not something that might happen in future. It's already happened. I think the only way to interpret what the United States is doing is that it's pushing back and saying, no, we're not going to respond to your challenge, or at least we're not going to accept your challenge to the status quo. We're going to resist it and aim to preserve the status quo of US primacy as a foundation for the Asian order and the underpinning of the US-China relationship indefinitely into the future. And I think the definitive statement of that was the President's very significant speech in Canberra this time last year. I think, therefore, all noting all the historical baggage that goes with this contentious word, I think US policy today is, in effect, one of containment and not, as the administration would say, one of shaping. It would be shaping if China hadn't already made the choice. It would be trying to shape China's choices, but the choice has already been made. So we have a Chinese challenge. And the response to it is, in effect, a resistance to that challenge, which I think has all of the key characteristics of containment. And again, I think that's understandable. It's really understandable that the United States wants to preserve the status quo. The question is simply, will it work? Is pushing back and resisting China's challenge, refusing to make any significant changes to the status quo, going to succeed? And that, of course, depends on how China, in turn, responds to America's response. And I think the response of containment, inverted commas, works if China pulls its head in. If China says, oh, sorry, we'll change our mind, we will accept American primacy indefinitely. I just don't think that's going to happen. It's not happening. What does China do? It pushes back in turn and pushes back a bit harder. That's how fights start. Then the big question is, well, how hard can it push? Can it? And here, it's a very big subject. I'm going to cover it very quickly. I take China's rise very seriously. It's not that I think it's going to rule the world. I don't think it's even going to be strong enough to rule Asia. But it is strong enough to prevent the United States sustaining the kind of primacy that the United States has exercised over the last 40 years if it pushes back. And I think it is going to push back. And that's partly a reflection of its sheer economic weight. This is, after all, the biggest shift in relative economic weight in a century or more. And I also think it's reflected in a shift in the balance of military and diplomatic power. I think the idea that underpins some aspects of American policy on this, that somehow the military, that America's strategic alliances and friendships in Asia and its military superiority counterbalance China's economic rise, is too optimistic. I won't pursue the argument behind that now, but I think in essence we're now at a position where the US, that China will be strong enough to prevent the United States successfully imposing primacy on it. And instead what happens is that we will end up with an unresolved escalating strategic rivalry in which neither the United States nor China can win, but everybody can lose. Because I think the costs and risks to both sides of sustained rivalry between the US and China are very high, partly because I think there reaches a point in which, as people keep on observing, containment is incompatible with interdependence, and so it starts to undermine the economic relationship which has been so important to both. But I also think the risks that at some point, and perhaps not very far in the future, a crisis emerges which the statescraft doesn't manage, and we end up with a conflict which escalates, is quite high. I don't for a moment think the conflict is inevitable, but in a policy business we don't deal with inevitabilities, we deal with possibilities. And the possibility of a conflict and the probability that if a conflict occurs, it escalates to the point where it's very hard to manage, I think is very high, and I think this has to weigh very heavily on everybody's calculations on both sides of the Pacific. So what that suggests is that containment's not a great strategy. But the then question is, what's the alternative? What other approach can the United States take? And I think one of the problems we all have with this, and not just on this side of the Pacific, but on the other side of the Pacific, is a tendency to think there are only two options. Either the United States supports the status quo, continues to be the primary power in Asia, China accepts subordination, or we flick over and China becomes the primary power in Asia and the United States in effect withdraws. If those are the only two options, then we've got a very bleak future. There's going to be an alternative, either Chinese primacy, hegemony, domination on the one hand, or sustained, intense US-China strategic competition on the other. So I'm here to say, I hope and I think there is a third option. The third option is rather hard to sketch. If China accepts that it can't assume primacy itself, and if the United States accepts that it can achieve its most important outcomes in Asia without maintaining primacy in the form that it's exercised it hitherto, if the United States can conceive a role for itself which balances China's power and prevents Chinese hegemony without asserting primacy as it has for the last 40 years, if they can find some way, in other words, clumsy verb, but I think it's the best I can come up with, to share power in Asia, then I think it's perfectly possible to envisage a relatively peaceful and stable Asian order, which accommodates China's power, meets what I hope the Chinese would recognise as being their minimum conditions, which is to be treated as an equal, satisfies China, and prevents escalating strategic rivalry. It's not that I think that's a very attractive model. I don't think it's nearly as attractive as uncontested US primacy. But the choice we face is not the choice between what we've had and this. It's the choice between this and escalating strategic rivalry and all the risks that carries. And if that's the choice, and I'm pretty sure it is, then I prefer that one. At least I think it's worth a try. And of course, we can't be sure it's available because we can't be sure that China would be willing to settle for as little as a position of equality. We can't be sure the Chinese will accept that the United States will stay a strong power in Asia, imposing significant constraints on what China can do with its power. We hope that the Chinese will be persuaded that would be in their best interests. And of course, I can't be sure that the United States will accept that. That the United States will accept a relationship essentially of equality with China, which will be different from the relationship that China has ever had, I think, with any power in its history, because America's history as an international player has always been so framed by America's extraordinary strength. So I don't say it's a terrific option. I don't say it's a simple option. I just say it's better than what seems to me to be the very credible alternative. I think, you know, when people ask me, as they often do, but what does this really look like? And people are interested, I can spell it out in a bit more detail. I have a story about that. But I'm inclined to turn the question over and say, I'll tell you a bit more what my side looks like. If you tell me what your side looks like, where does the present trend of US-China relationships go? Tell me where this ends, as General Petraeus said. Where are we 10 years from now if the next 10 years look, as I think they very credibly will, like the last few years? So I think there's a challenge to both sides to spell out how their model looks. Last point. Many of you will think, hang on, what about all our friends and allies in Asia? Don't they want America to stay engaged? Of course they do. But we just have to push the analysis two steps further. Everybody in Asia, fears living under China's domination. So everybody in Asia recognises that a very strong American role in Asia is the only way, or by far and away the best way, to avoid living under Chinese domination. So everybody wants the United States to stay engaged, no doubt about that. But everybody in Asia wants a good relationship with China, because everyone in Asia, like Australia, sees China as being terribly important to their future, economically, but not just economically. China is a big, and although not in the soft power sense nearly as attractive as the United States, it's still a big place that you want to feel you can work with. Moreover, everybody in Asia fears the implications for them of US-China strategic rivalry, not just because they might be forced to make the choice, but because they might become a battleground between two immensely powerful and probably rather ruthless states when it comes to war. So everybody wants the United States to stay engaged in Asia, but everyone wants the United States to stay engaged in Asia in a way that avoids escalating strategic rivalry with China. And therefore that means they want the United States to stay in Asia in a way, if it's possible, if China's willing to do this deal, which China's prepared to accept. In other words, they want the United States to stay, but they want the United States to stay on the basis that I'm talking about, rather than on a basis in which the United States resists any modifications of the status quo. Now, in Asia, of course, as here, and for that matter as in Australia, we're still kind of mesmerised by how marvellous the last 40 years it's been. It's been the best 40 years in Asia's millennia of history, because for the first time, the primacy of the United States has been uncontested by any other power. That's now passed. And if we ask ourselves, how do we go from here? I've got to say, I do think the thought of America doing a very radical thing and reconceiving its relationship with Asia and its relationship with China and its role in Asia is an essential first step. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Hugh. That was fantastic. Chris?
Yeah. I'm very glad to appear on the panel with you. Thanks. That was very good remarks. I think in terms of the fundamentals of certainly China's ambitions, I don't think we're that far apart, actually. I do think that China sees for itself a desire to reestablish its dominant position, in, or its predominant position, as the number one power in East Asia. I guess I'm not as convinced as you, though, that they see this, at least in the term we're talking about, as fundamentally meaning that they have to push the United States out, you know, or challenge so directly, you know, U.S. Current status. Now, where I agree with you is that they would not define it as U.S. predominance. That I think they are seeking to, you know, challenge and weaken. And I think you're absolutely correct that we are seeing signs that China has already made the decision in some ways to challenge. But I don't think that is an irreversible decision. And in fact, I think we're seeing some signs that it's one that is very much at contention within their system.
Yeah.
So I would say fundamentally, I think I agree with you that China's goals are to achieve this. I simply think that inside their system, they haven't worked this out yet. And actually, I think that makes it more dangerous in some ways than if they had actually already conceived, you know, a solid plan. I'm always, having watched them for a good long time now, I'm always concerned when people have a tendency to translate the inscrutable Mandarin and so on and their master planning as somehow thinking that there is some grand strategic aura here. I don't think so. I think they're crossing the river by feeling the stones on a lot of this.
Yeah.
And I think that has implications for what you've said.
Yeah.
You know. And so to me it translates into what is the state of the relationship.
Yeah.
And I, if I hear you correctly, you know, you see it as very negative and on a very negative forward track, and you know this is true in some way. The idea of deepening strategic mutual distrust is real. This is a phenomenon. There's no two ways about it. I happen to think it's not as deep as people have been speculating. My own sense is that we're in a unique period, some of which is related to what you have pointed out, which is that there's been a shift in the power relationship. I personally think that shift is not permanent, and in fact, that the mood, and a lot of it is driven by the moods inside the two countries, you know. And in many ways, the mood in the United States following the global financial crisis and so on is negative, is pessimistic, you know, and as about its own influence and power and ability to shape things. And as such, it tends to then project, you know, onto the Chinese viewpoint, this rising, you know, sort of idea. Likewise, I think China, coming out of the global financial crisis, no doubt, you know, was projecting very much a view, it's our time. You know, there were substantial voices inside the system. They're still there, you know, and they're still influential. I think, You know, we watched this cycle in 2009, 2010, where what was striking to me about what happened at that time was the speed with which that debate, which seemed to start at a fairly low level within the Chinese system, went to the very top,
that's right.
You know, and in fact required suppression from the very top bounding, you know, from Hu Jintao himself through the offices of his foreign policy right-hand man, Dai Bingguo.
Yeah.
I think what then happened was there was a mistaken view that folks tended to assume then that that meant the debate was resolved, and I think that's where you're correct. It is not resolved.
Yeah.
It has been being artificially suppressed by the desire for stability as they get through the leadership transition, as one point. Secondly, it has been suppressed by, you know, this desire to just, we can't do this now, you know, kind of a philosophy. And I think some legitimate recognition on their part that they made some mistakes in that 2009-2010 period. I mean, Dai Bingguo came out, I think, in his various speeches quite directly and internally, certainly said to the assembled multitudes, it's not the U.S., it's us.
Yeah.
You know, we're the ones who made a mistake here with our approach and so on. Unfortunately, that idea doesn't seem to have stuck. And now, you know, we're seeing, I think, another cycle of this. And what's interesting is, what are Xi Jinping's views, you know, and philosophies going to be on this? I think there's certainly been some, shall we say, worrisome signs, you know, that he's directing some of this, or that he has this kind of, he may have some, perhaps some reformist thinking, but he's a nationalist, you know, very much so, and and as a son of the party, and you know, proud of the party, and wants to see China do well, so that's true. But I guess my sense is I see more hope that now that we're past our respective, you know, we had a really odd convergence this year. It only happens roughly every 20 years by their respective
cycles,
calendars, that we would have, you know, a U.S. presidential election and a Chinese leadership transition in the same year.
Yes.
So my sense is that with both sides having been fundamentally distracted this year, now the question is, okay, it's time to come back, you know, to doing business. And will we embark on this deepening path of strategic mutual distrust? Or will, in fact, both sides decide that, you know, we can't get this wrong? And I think that the signaling has been such that I'm more optimistic, I guess, than you about the potentialities that we will work it out. It doesn't mean that it's going to be easy. It's going to be very difficult. And I think it's going to require bold leadership and strong leadership on both sides at the very top to make these signals. I mean, one of the difficulties, for example, that I see is, my sense is Xi Jinping is certainly an economic nationalist.
Yes.
I think our president in some ways is an economic nationalist. So this is going to create tension in the economic relationship, and that's going to be challenging. We're going to have to work on that. But I still see that there's a situation where, unlike previous such rivalries, the economic interdependence is such, the 21st century global situation is such, that it will be very, very difficult, you know, for us, I think, to kind of pursue this negative path. Doesn't mean it's not possible. And I think the primary challenge for both leaderships is calming the voices inside their own systems that are calling, you know, for this sort of thing. Secondly, you know, what is the sort of state of the U.S. pushback? And is it a containment policy? You know, my sense is it's not. I mean, if this is a containment policy, it's the worst containment policy that's ever been designed. Right? You know? I mean, it's pretty sloppy if that's the if that's the goal. It doesn't mean that you're ever going to convince the Chinese, right, that it's not a containment policy. And therein may be where you're really going. And in other words, they see it that way no matter what we do, and that drives their strategic thinking and approach and responses and. And that I wouldn't dispute with you, but my sense is that the U.S. policy is very much what it says it is, which is to try to provide stability in the region, to try to act as a strategic shaper. I think you make a very valid point, though, about is it too late to shape? That's a reasonable point, especially with regard to the trend line in Chinese military modernization and you know, some of the things they're doing in terms of access denial and so on.
Yeah.
But I guess my sense is that, you know, there are ways we can convince the Chinese that it's not a containment policy. And one of those ways is, I think I'm quite impressed by the way that the administration has recalibrated. You know, you mentioned the speech in Canberra, and that's true. I think our friends in the region were quick to tell us that this can't just be about security and military movements. It has to be an economic component, because what was China doing in the early stage to counter? The U.S. is all about military and security. We're about growth and trade and development, and they're the troublemaker, right? So I think you've seen a very decided move by the administration to try to rebalance that, rebalance the rebalancing
yes.
to some degree, and to get more of an economic component in there. And that makes me hopeful that we can have that as an option. Mm-hmm. And then the idea that China will push back harder to our pushback.
Yeah, right.
There is some truth in that. I think we're seeing it right now in the Senkaku behavior and in some of the renewed South China Sea behavior. I wonder if they're pushing back harder, or if they're simply testing the fences instead.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
And seeing if we will really push back harder. You know, if they test the fences.
Yeah.
And or are we a paper tiger? You know, on some of these issues. Those voices are there. You know, I heard them when I was in Beijing recently, and they're doing a lot of victory lapping. You know, inside about the Senkaku piece in particular.
Yeah.
And I think they understand this is a very challenging policy dilemma. For the United States, we have a very limited toolkit in these type of issues that we can use. We have rhetoric, which we're using, you know, right now, trying to get all sides to react calmly and so on.
Yep.
And then we have a much more robust military response,
right.
which is what you're concerned about, and I think what the region is also concerned about. And so trying to find the balance there is very, very challenging, and I think China perceives it that way. And they also, I think that perhaps wrongly, that the regional dynamics are such, their economic growth and so on are such that they can do this and the region won't squawk too badly.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fundamental miscalculation on their part. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't have strategic consequences that should worry us. And then finally, just in closing, the next 10 years will look like the last few. I guess I disagree quite fundamentally there. My sense is that the U.S. economy, you know, if we can just finally admit to ourselves that this is a structural recession, not a cyclical one, and as such will take some great number of years to unwind, I think we need to be a lot more honest about that in our public discussion, because it resets people's expectations when you do that, right?
Yeah.
And then just the energy revolution in the U.S., you know, and so on. So my point is that the mood that has been causing the problems that you state in the bilateral relationship in the U.S. will be different in the next five-ish years. I think the U.S. will be, again, much more confident as the economic health helpfully restores and so on. And they'll feel back in a better position to deal with the relationship from a position of strength, you know, and I think that's important. Not military strength, just confidence strength, you know.
Yeah.
Likewise, I think in China, you know, the demographic problems that are setting in, the trouble they're having adjusting the economic model, the pressures that they're facing internally, socially, you know, in terms of Gini coefficient problems, you know, the whole nine yards. This is going to cause real issues for them. And I think, you know, the new leadership team has been signaling quite fundamentally that they want to focus primarily on these internal issues, you know. And as such, their confidence may be weakened a little bit. I mean, I think it's fair to say that this declinist school was quite prominent in that earlier period I referenced. I think they've been kicked in the face pretty hard. and you don't hear these guys as loudly. Now, it doesn't mean that they won't come back, you know. And this is the thing. I think it's important to understand that in both societies, the mood is a sine wave, you know.
Yeah.
And where and when those sine waves interact and intersect is important. But I think it's wrong to put us on an asymptotic, you know, trajectory toward the current, you know, state of affairs. I much like our own fiscal problem, you know, at the moment, I think we're one compromise away from a good deal, you know. And likewise, in the U.S.-China relationship, I think these forces are going to, you know, come to bear in such a way that we'll find out we have to do this. You know, just quickly to end on that, Xi Jinping, I'm quite optimistic, actually, about, you know, his approach to the relationship. He understands the United States far better than Hu Jintao did when he first came in to power, I think. He has visited here many times. His daughter goes here, to school here, all of these sort of things. And I just think he has a better touch, you know, really, for how to manage the relationship. So I find that encouraging. I also think he's been empowered in a way that Hu wasn't, that frankly allowed a lot of the other actors in the system to create this containment narrative that we've been seeing.
Yeah.
So what I'm looking for to make my own predictions come into play will be, will he take charge at the top of the system and do what is necessary to suppress, you know, these voices that are calling for this kind of deterministic struggle between the two sides?
Yeah.
And to put the relationship on a better footing. It's going to take leadership, and it's going to take, he has to make a decision that he's going to arrest the drift that you referred to, not simply allow it to continue because it's easier for him to consolidate power that way.
Thank you, Chris. Hugh, I want to give you a chance to sort of respond to some of those points, and then I have a question, then we'll open the floor to some observations and questions.
Well, thanks very much. A very terrific set of observations, Chris, and I agree with a lot of them. Let me just touch on 4 points. The first is I agree we need to be careful not to overstate China's power, but I think one area where we differ is I do think that China's economic growth has already made it a much more formidable power than it's ever been before. And although there are lots of issues and problems, as you say, I think we need to be very careful not to underestimate just how substantial China has become. I mean, it's the contrast with where it was in 1972. The contrast is stark. On the other hand, I absolutely agree with you, and this is this is as much a perception question as a reality question, and I think one of the very grave risks is that China overestimates its own power and very seriously underestimates American power. And one of the keys to this is for both sides to recognize very clearly the strengths and weaknesses of one another's position. And I think one of the risks that I see is that both sides are having difficulty in that. I mean, the converse of that is the way I'm absolutely not a US declinist. None of my argument is an argument that the United States is in decline. It's just an argument that China is growing. And that's a very significant difference. I have very high levels of confidence the United States can do what the United States always does and will do that. But I don't think that will change situation that we're likely to face in China, a country which is stronger relative to the United States in the basic economic foundation of power than any country has ever been since you guys overtook the Brits in the 1880s. And that's different. And power, you know, that makes a difference. The second point is about the question about, you know, is it containment or not? And I think, you know, the core thought there is that because the decision's already been made, it does, you know, it is, as you say, too late to shape. I think the question we need to sort out there is, well, how can that work in relation to interdependence? And I think the point about interdependence as a stabilizing factor in the relationship is terribly important. One of the reasons why I'm relatively optimistic that the US and China can build a stable order is that both sides have such an immense stake in doing so. But what that means is the interdependence increases the incentives for both sides to make the compromise necessary to do that. It doesn't remove the necessity for doing that. And, of course, if they're rational, they will see that that's in their interests. But if nations always conducted their affairs rationally, we wouldn't need a Center for the Strategic International Study. We just need the Center for International Economics. We'd all be rational economic people. We're not. States like people keep on doing really stupid things. Now, I actually do also very much agree with you that there's more sophistication in the US position than I'm perhaps making out, in the sense that if you just take the Obama speech, which I do think was very stark, and sort of take that as a single data point, then you get a much starker picture than is justified. But I think the critical thing is not so much that the US has broadened it away from the sort of broadly militarized component or feature of the Obama speech to include other things, although I think that's significant. I think it's more the question is the extent to which the United States has already indicated, to some extent, a willingness to do the kind of deal I'm talking about. And I think the most significant point there was, to me, a really remarkable speech that Hillary Clinton gave at the US Institute of Peace, marking the 40th anniversary of the visit, in which she said some, to me, very significant things. And right at the core of that speech, there were two propositions. The first is that the US-China relationship is going to look different in future than it did in the past, and not just a little bit different. I think she acknowledged it will be a very different kind of relationship. And the second thing was that she came very close, if she didn't actually use these words, to acknowledging that new relationship will need to be negotiated with China. The terms of that relationship can't be dictated by the United States. Now, that is, it's a small step, but it's actually a very significant step. It's going to be different, and we're not going to be able to, we won't be able to dictate how it is. A very significant series of steps to take. But of course, the messages are mixed, and likewise on the Chinese side. Sometimes the Chinese say, as Xi Jinping did earlier this year, here, that, you know, we welcome the United States continuing to play a strong role in the Western Pacific. That's nice. And at other times, they say, the United States has no role in the South China Sea. Now, I spend some time saying to my Chinese friends, guys, this can't both be right. You can't say the United States, you know, your bloke saying the United States needs to play a strong role, and you think it has no role in this issue? Of course it does.
Yeah.
So I think in both sides, the messages are mixed, and I think your point about the way this plays into the politics and so on is absolutely spot on. I'll leave it. I think that your points about the politics issue, I think, are very interesting and very significant. Yeah.
Can I just throw in one half a minute thing?
Yeah.
I think my sense too, as well, is that I'm glad you raised Secretary Clinton's speech, because I think it was a model for where things are going. And this really is the challenge, isn't it? Because Xi Jinping comes to the United States and visits, and he says that he wants a new style of great power relations.
Yes.
And Secretary Clinton goes to Beijing and says, we're trying to write a new answer to this historical question of how does an enduring... I like the fact that you use the term enduring power, not status quo power, the United
States.
That's good. Except an ascending power in China, without conflict.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, both of those two points of view suggest the desire to work this out, mutual good and so on. Of course, hidden behind both, though, is an acknowledgement that it could be an old style of power relations.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
in some ways, I agree with you that that kind of recognition of that as a possibility does highlight how the relationship will be fundamentally different going forward.
Yes,
I want to ask you both, in discussions I have with Chinese colleagues who are visiting Washington and who are here, there's a repeated theme that they're asking, about the United States' ability or commitment to staying power in Asia. I think they're asking three questions. Pocketbook, will we be able to finance it? Politics, do we have the political will? Are we interested to stay in Asia as Americans?
Yeah.
And then it's people. I mean, that's sort of the transition, Hillary Clinton and, people like Gates and Panetta leaving. And will they be replaced with Asianists or strategic thinkers?
Yeah.
Or will they be replaced with people who have other priorities? And the Middle East is always lingering in their analysis. Could you guys react to that?
Yeah.
What is the Chinese perception?
Well, I think there are two ways of complaining about U.S. in Asia. The one is that you're ignoring us, and the other is that you're monstering us.
Right.
And the great thing seems to me about being an American diplomat in Asia is quite possibly be accused of both at once. And to a certain extent, that's what's happening in the United States at the moment. I've got to say, I don't think for a moment that the United States does not have and will not continue to have the strength to play a very strong role in Asia, indeed, and a role easily big enough to prevent China dominating Asia if the United States chooses to do it. I do think there's a question as to whether the United States will decide that its interests warrant the costs and risks of escalating strategic rivalry with China if that's what proceeds. And I think there is a risk, although far from being kind of U.S. is going to withdraw, Cato Institute sort of model. but I do think there is a risk that the U.S., if rivalry with China escalates, the United States will find itself facing extremely high costs. And particularly in crises, very awkward decisions. And the question, do you actually really want to risk nuclear war with China over the Senkakus, will not be a hypothetical one. And really, and it's not an easy one, because if you're not prepared to do it with Senkakus, then you're saying something very serious about the future of the Japan relationship. Now, if I was Japanese, for example, and they have a slightly different perspective on these things because they're both geographically and historically much closer to China, neither of which seems necessarily to generate affection. They have a question as to whether the United States is going to be willing to pay the costs and risks of that. But that's not because of U.S. weakness. It's because those costs and risks are very and perhaps astronomically high. And so I think it's understandable that people have doubts about that. In China, I think the risk is that they do not just underestimate American power and overestimate their own, but underestimate the scale of America's commitment.
Yes.
And I think there's a bit of a sense that the United States can just be persuaded to stay out of this. And this is one of the ways in which the interdependence thing cuts in. In theory, what should happen with interdependence is that I recognize that I depend on you, and you recognize that you depend on me, and so we both recognize we better stop this.
Yeah.
But I have a very consistent pattern of conversations with Americans and Chinese in which the Americans say, Hugh, you're way too gloomy about the future of the U.S.-China relationship because the Chinese understand they can't afford to violate this. And Chinese say, not in quite these terms, Hugh, you're way too gloomy about the future of our relationship because Americans understand. Now, the fact that what that means is the interdependence actually increases the risk mm-hmm. of escalating rivalry because both overestimate their own position, underestimate the others. And you know, I'm just going to say in conversations in Washington so far this week, I've heard that first line a few times. Mm-hmm. And I certainly hear it in China. It's exactly the point that you both touched on in China. There is this sort of, you know, you know, they need us more than we need them. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, in a sense, almost amplifies the risks.
Yeah. Do you want to comment?
Just real quickly, I think that you identified the three fundamental issues, you know, that are making people nervous. And I think that the reason why is that as part of what the United States is doing, you know, with this strategic rebalancing policy, we are asking the regional allies to get out on the limb with us. You know, and to some degree start sawing,
That's right.
In terms of their relationship with China.
Exactly.
And they're concerned, I think, that there won't be, for lack of a better term, you know, a bright, shiny object, you know, that, that goes by, you know, and distracts the attention, you know, of the U.S. And you know, look at the recent EAS. You know, obviously, we had great presence. It was, you know, this has been a fantastic thing the administration has done. Where did Secretary Clinton go immediately after to the Middle East? Because she had to, you know. And this is something that that people in the region think about, you know. And so I think what, and I think the administration is doing this, what we need to do is to continue to demonstrate the solidity of the commitment. Yes. I think Hugh is right that inside China, there is a calculus. I mean, I think when the speech was made and the policy was initially rolled out, of course, China's external reaction was, you know, we don't think the U.S. ever left. We welcome their presence, yada, yada, yada. Internally, I think there was they don't have the staying power, so we're okay.
You know. I definitely sense
and
that.
And some of that, though, I think is also a justification to themselves because they felt, well, we can't really deal with the true strategic implications of this because of our own political food fight right now. So we'll say they won't be able to deal with it. Yeah. I actually think this is one of the problems, and I think, Hugh, this is one of the things that's raising a lot of the specters that you've identified, is that fundamentally the Chinese, I mean, this is a, you know, you can argue about the meat and potatoes of it, but this is a grand strategic move by the United States.
Yes. Absolutely.
And as such, China has not yet, in my assessment, done that kind of top-level review of what this means for their external security environment.
Yes.
How do they do that?
Well, they have to basically, Xi Jinping has to call, you know, they're going to have to call a session. I mean, this is going to require a new set of what they call TIFA, you know, these internal guidelines.
Yes.
And when they do these things, they're very deliberate. They'll tell us what it is, you know, after they've concluded it.
Yes.
And since we haven't seen that yet, that suggests strongly to me they haven't done it yet. And in the absence of that high-level discussion, the other elements in this increasingly pluralized society are able to run, you know, loosely a little bit without that kind of stricture. So I think now that she, especially that the transition was, shall we say, smoother than the last time, he's gotten all the key portfolios in one go, which I think was quite deliberate.
Yeah.
And that clears the way for him to sit down with the new Politburo and have this talk. And so I think we'll have to look and see. Now, it doesn't mean that they're going to come out with an assessment that says, we accept, what the U.S. is doing. It could be quite the opposite.
Yeah.
But I think that the fact that hasn't happened yet makes everything seem more uncertain. The uncertainty breeds fear, and that, you know, creates the difficulties that might be fixed.
One question before we go to the audience. Do the Americans have the interlocutors with China to receive those messages before they're clear, or could Australia or other Asian countries play that role? What's your assessment?
I mean, I don't quite understand your
Do
question.
We have the Henry Kissingers
physically
the receptors in place hear them?
I think so. I mean, you know, to some degree, those folks are still playing that role.
Right.
But also, I guess where I come down fundamentally is the Chinese have to sort the laundry, you know, first. But when they've done so, I think they do have mechanisms for transmitting.
Let's open it up. This has been a great discussion. Andre.
Thank you.
There's a microphone here.
I'm the chief representative in Vietnam, a long-term resident of Vietnam, for the Interstate Traveler Company in Detroit and another company in Malaysia. But anyway, my question is a great discussion. I mean, I've never heard anything so good in so short a time. But here's my question. I don't see any mutual exclusivity between the basic theory that you gave us, Professor White, and you so ably elaborated on the U.S. perspectives and all. But I agree that the broad concept, the broad point you made, I think is unassailable, that the best future for all concerned is in what you called power sharing. Without the clear, outspoken predominance of either China or the United States, I don't see why either country ultimately needs that. So to get there, my question is, wouldn't part of the best part of American policy, which the Obama administration I think is gravitating towards, but nevertheless, wouldn't the best part of the best formula to be to insist, maybe not in an overt way, but I mean to work towards a de facto insistence with China that they respect the basic international law as it pertains to respecting the sovereignty of other countries, and also the UN 1982 Convention on the Law of the Sea. There is no morally or geopolitically good reason that China has to encroach on the exclusive economic zones of Vietnam and the Philippines and others, but they do it. And they do it with violence and the threat of violence. They try to scare India off of implementing signed contracts with the state petroleum country, Petro-Vietnam. So there's no excuse for that. And I think that's where we should draw the line with whatever nuances and complexities we do that.
Thanks,
but
Sandy.
Wouldn't that be a good part unnecessary?
Care to respond?
Well, I think you've hit on a very critical point, because when we talk about these issues, we are talking about grand architecture. We're also talking about the management of a whole lot of very specific issues, and I think, as it happens, the questions about how China asserts its views of its own maritime rights and how the rest of us respond is right at the heart of that. And it's not, as the old communists would have said, a coincidence that the issue in which China most overtly chooses to challenge the present management of the order is at sea, because that's where the United States' position has always been most primary, and I think where China feels it has some advantages. So let me give you a complex and, I fear, in some ways not very satisfying answer. Obviously, we're going to want to make sure in this negotiation with China that one of the things, a very high negotiating priority in that deal, is to reach an agreement on how China manages, how China sees its roles at sea, which is consistent with exactly the principles that you mentioned. On the other hand, we do need to bear in mind that every time we say this is non-negotiable with China, we're saying that we're prepared to abandon the hopes for the kind of power sharing that I'm talking about. If we say this is non-negotiable, then when we're running the risk that China will say, well, that's non-negotiable for us too, and so both sides walk away from the table. Now, there are some things which are non-negotiable. We've all read our history books. We know what happened in 1938. But no, you can't have the rest of Czechoslovakia. So there are some lines to be drawn. But every time we say this is non-negotiable, we're saying this is so serious that we're prepared to accept a significantly increased risk of a really major war in order to protect it. Now, some things are worth that. But what we'll have to do is to make a whole lot of very difficult, sometimes tragic, case-by-case decisions about this. But I guess my starting point on this, it sort of comes from being too strategically oriented, I guess, is that on right at the heart of all of these choices is the responsibility we all have to manage down as far as we can without sacrificing the most important things, the risk of war. Mm-hmm. And that's going to make some of these choices very difficult.
I'm going to take some other questions here and here.
I'm Ian Chong. I'm from the National University of Singapore, and I'm visiting at the East-West Center. So coming from the same side of the Pacific as you do, I don't know, the debates back home in ASEAN and also in Singapore don't seem to sort of land that clearly on the U.S.'s containing China camp. So I'm wondering what indicators you're using. You didn't really elaborate. I hope you'd be able to tell us why you think the U.S. is already containing China. And I guess the other side point is I'm wondering, you talk about getting some kind of U.S.-China condominium. What would it take for the United States and China to accept that sort of position of equality, which you recognize is very hard to do?
Yeah. Well, a very good pair of questions. Let me deal with the second one first. It's a very long. What would it take? What would it mean? What would it look like?
Yeah.
There's a whole book in that. But let's just give. in fact, I've written it.
But I knew that was good.
But let me give you the shorthand. It requires both countries to be willing to accept a vision of their own role in the Asian order, which is different from their preferences, because they recognise that the cost and risks to them of not doing a deal are higher. So it's a matter of balancing the utility between getting what they want and what they have to pay for it.
And how would we get there?
Now, the point about how we get there, the first point to note is I am not here predicting that that is the order that will emerge. I think actually it's much more likely that such an order won't emerge and that instead we will end up with a progressing towards escalating strategic rivalry, which will make our life and your lives, as well as everybody's lives, much, much harder. In fact, I spent a lot of time thinking about this, and the more I look at it, the harder it looks, and the gloomier I become. But I don't think it's impossible, because I do think in the end that, and this really, partly goes to Chris' points, that there are actually quite sophisticated leaderships in both countries. I don't lie awake at night wondering that the US and China can't talk to one another more. I see no role for Australia or others as intermediaries. I think actually the capacity of the United States and China to talk to one another is quite good as long as they've worked out what they're prepared to say to one another. And that requires them, of course, because what this means for both countries, the most important foreign policy decisions and debates are always the ones you have at home about your own position, because that in the end goes to the kind of country you are. And China is going to have a debate with itself about the kind of country it's going to be. Bill Clinton once used a marvellous phrase, how China defines its greatness. And China has to decide how it defines its greatness. If it defines greatness as being, again, the primary power in Asia, then we've got a very gloomy future because the rest of Asia is not going to accept it. On the other hand, how does America define its greatness? If America defines its greatness as preserving forever the position that history gave it in the remarkable circumstances of the post-war and particularly post-Cold War era, then we're going to have a very gloomy future. And so both countries are going to have to sort of sit at home, think about themselves, talk to one another. And do I think that's possible? Yes, partly because interdependence being not all the rest of it, there's a huge stake, both of them, their whole future is at stake in this. Is it hard? You bet.
I'm just going to amplify a couple of things that you said. I really like your point. It is about the quality of the discussion,
yes.
The qualitative nature of the discussion.
Yes.
You can meet on the margins of APEC and on the margins of NSS and all these other fora that have been created, but we all know how those go. It's a 45-minute meeting.
That's right.
There's a 25-minute mutual exchange of talking points that must be gotten through.
Yeah.
There's translation, et cetera. So you get maybe 10 minutes of real talk time.
Yeah.
I think this is something that was so fundamentally valuable about the way both China and the United States planned the exchange of vice presidential visits.
Yes,
they had substantial time with each other, traveling together, talking, really getting that going. And then the qualitative discussion inside.
Yes.
I'm much more comfortable about the prospects for a good qualitative discussion here than I am in China, because one of the things they have to do in China to get to where you want us to all to be, and I think all of us want us all to be, a good positive relationship, is that they're going to have to touch some third rails, such as, we saw this in the last round in the 2009-2010 debate, what are we going to do about Deng Xiaoping's, Biden-Hyde theory? The reality of the situation is, it is ridiculous for China to Biden-Hyde in its current capacity.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but to change the dictum, someone has to touch the legacy.
That's
and that takes leadership and power, we're going to have to watch how that goes.
I think that we could take, I'm sorry, we can only take one more question. I think that was here.
Thank you very much. Henning Speck from the German Embassy. I have a question. Of course, the relationship between the U.S. And China is at the center of today's discussion. However, since the world is increasingly multipolar and also the region is increasingly multipolar, and Ernie is following very much what's going on in Southeast Asia, my question is, are there any regional actors like ASEAN or individual countries, Australia, who could help to reach this sort of perfect equilibrium, designing the games and rule in an own way? And the adjacent question I would have is, do you see, and obviously that's an interesting coming from Europe, is there any way that Europe could influence the rules of the game, given the fact that they don't have sort of that military presence and footstep in the region, but merely sort of an economic, political footstep?
Maybe I could jump in there just quickly. I mean, we didn't really get to this. I'm glad you raised the question. I think the fact of regional architecture, the new regional architecture, is really important, and it's we're getting putting a step on the road in that direction. I think it's really important. If I look at scenarios in the South China Sea, for instance, and I do, I think the best possible scenario is joint development and an agreement to use those seas as seas that connect and prosper the region. I think there's a critical role for regional architecture, first of all. I think the EAS, the East Asia Summit, is a body that could help convince China to play by rules, make rules with its neighbors, and play by those rules. And if you talk to the ASEAN guys who are around in the 60s, when ASEAN was formed in Bangkok, they say, we've seen this movie before. You guys forgot about it.
Yeah.
Indonesia was a big, bulky neighbor, messy, ideological. We didn't know what to do with these guys. We formed ASEAN. You guys are all so miserable about what ASEAN can do. And what. But actually, look, we convinced the Indonesians that they could be the big guy in the neighborhood. Suharto played ball. He nodded and waved. And you know, we got through, and we actually prospered. We can do this again with China, but we need the ballast of the United States at the table. You've got to be there. We need the ballast of the Indians to be more there than just rhetorically. And I think, you know, to answer your question on Europe, I mean, I think Europe does play a role in that. The fact that Europe is interested in Asia more than it has been in the past, the fact that of the European participation that was pretty good at the recent meeting in Laos is another strong signal to the region that gives them confidence to be out on that branch and maybe not have to saw as hard, you know. I think that's really important.
Image.
So, I mean, that would be my take. You guys want to...
If I could just... Yes, it's a very interesting and important subject. I completely agree with Ernie that actually, despite appearances, particularly appearances from people who look at it from a European perspective, actually the Asian multilateral structures are in their way pretty good, actually. And ASEAN, I completely agree. I think people who criticise ASEAN because it doesn't do anything, I think are getting it wrong. I think ASEAN has been a terrific success. But I would draw a contrast between... ASEAN's capacity to manage issues, including significant issues like the South China Sea on the one hand, and its capacity to manage a fundamental transformation of the Asian order. ASEAN is itself a complete child of the post-Cold War in Asia, post-1972 environment. Historical sort of starting points go back a bit before, but ASEAN has worked because we've been living in an environment in which the major powers haven't competed, and therefore the middle powers have been able to do all sorts of things. Mm. Now, what happens when the major powers start to compete, and we're watching this happening right now, is they get their fingers into that institution, start to pull it apart. So I think in order for the... So I think the problem is that what we need is a little bit like the relationship between a parliament and a constituent, an assembly drafting a new constitution. The ASEAN and the bodies that have built up around it, including the East Asian Summit and so on, are very good institutions for managing the day-by-day, year-by-year business of the region, including really important issues like South China Sea. Mm-hmm. But it's got to be supported by or reflect consonant with a fundamental understanding about the power relationships in the region. And because that's shifting, I don't think the ASEAN itself or any of those bodies can do much to help that. It's the old routine that for the US and China to get to where they want to getting back to my answer before, that both sides are going to have to make some huge sacrifices and compromises with the other. They're not going to make those compromises in a grand ballroom of a hotel in Singapore with the crossed flags on the table and little bowls of mints and all the rest of it. They're going to do it in a dark and, at least on the Chinese side, smoke-filled room, just with the two of them there. It's not going to be pretty,
well,
but as long as it works. And so I think what we need to preserve those institutions. They're very important to us. But in order for that to work, these big guys are going to have to go off by themselves for a while and sort this one out.
Well, Hugh, that's there's a whole new chapter for us to debate this, because I think to save face, we got to take the nose of the Chinese right off the nose of the Americans.
Yes.
And you got to create a context for people to be able to compromise. But anyway, we're over time. I think this was a great discussion. I really apologize to the people who had, other people who had questions. That's a good sign that we're onto something really interesting here. I hope, I also want to say just parenthetically, we didn't get a chance to talk much about Australia, but the fact that your voice is raising these issues in such a, you know, I would say provocative but constructive way is really a great role from that we see from you and also from Australia. So thank you for that.
Really,
I think as Americans, we'd all thank you. So please join me in thanking both of our discussants. Thank you for doing that.
Oh, my pleasure.
Remember to turn off your mics.
It was really good. Good to meet you.
Not really enjoyable.
Thanks. Oh, yeah.